Hey everyone, and welcome to the third of three lectures being sponsored by Torah Motion on the subject of tracing the origin of the structure of the Siddur. My name is Abe Katz, and I'll be presenting tonight's shiur. The topic for tonight is historical circumstances that have made a major impact upon the Siddur. What I have uploaded for you to look at is not an ancient Siddur, it's actually a Siddur that was published in Tovshin Yud Aleph, as you see. Where's my pointer? Okay, there we go. That would be probably about 66 years ago. What's interesting about this Siddur, as I explained to you in the first shiur, we now have two types of digital databases that we can search through. We have the type of digital database, such as the Bar Ilan CD, in which the compilers of that CD have typed in the text of several thousand Siddurim, and we can search those Siddurim. We also have a second type of digital library where we can see the actual Siddurim. This is what you're looking at. This is a Siddur that I found at HebrewBooks.org. And as I explained to you, there are certain things about the Siddur that you can't see or cannot learn unless you see the actual Siddurim. So, example, in this case, we have the place of publication, Livorno. That is a city in Italy. Before World War II, there were 18 Hebrew publishing companies in Livorno, Italy. It was a very important center of Hebrew book publishing. The reason why it became such a popular place for Hebrew book publishing is because of its close proximity to the Mediterranean and also to the Sephardic communities that were in northern Africa and in the Arabic countries. And so they had a ready customer base for which they produced Siddurim. And as you see, this is Keminhag Kahal Kadosh Sfardim. There is another interesting aspect to this title page, and that is the name of the publisher. Let me make it a little bigger so you can see it. And bring it down, bring it up for you. Now it's easier if I shut off my pointer. Okay, here is, I'll bring back the pointer. The name of the publisher is Shlomo Belaporte v'Chaveiro, Solomon Belaporte and his friends. This publishing company had to close because in 1939 because of the outbreak of World War II. What's interesting is that I Googled this book publishing company, and I found out that they actually reestablished themselves after World War II. And you might find it interesting to see what the publishing company looks like today, or their trade name. I found this on a webpage that promotes publishing companies from Italy. And as you see, I gotta shut off the pointer again. Okay. As you see, they have given themselves a new trade name. It's spelled Forte and C Editori SRL. And they're not ashamed to admit Belforte Publishing began its activity in 1834 as a small printing house for books in Hebrew. Let's go back. And now you can look at this later, see what they are publishing these days. Let's go back to the Siddur. And see why it is that I wanted you to see it. You are now looking at their pages of Shema Yisrael. I'll let you take a look at it. And I pointed out in yellow an unusual insertion that was made here by the publisher. And I think you can tell pretty quickly that what you are looking at are the first few words of each of the Aseres HaDibros. And just to check to see that all 10 are here, we can count them. We have 1, Anochi Hashem, 2, Lo Yeh, 3, Lo Sisa, Lo Sachmod, Lo Signov, You have Votir Tzach, Kabedez Avicha, Votinaf, Zohor Shema Shabbos, Losan Avriacha. I believe all 10 are there. So the question I have for you is, why would a book publisher in the early 1900s publish a version, a Sidur, in which he inserts into the lines of Kriya Shema the opening words of each of the Aseres Adibros? The answer to this question lies in a Mishnah. So let's go to our source sheet for lecture number 3. Let's make it a little bigger. Although it makes it a little smaller. Oops, not that small. Okay, I guess I shouldn't play with this. All right, we'll work with this. Okay, that's good. Okay, now I'll use my pointer. We're going to look at this Mishnah. This Mishnah is unusual because it's going to be describing a prayer service that took place before the destruction of Beit HaMikdash. As I explained in the first lecture, we have very little evidence of what tefillah looked like before the destruction of Beit HaMikdash. This Mishnah gives us some idea of one aspect of tefillah that did exist before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Now let's read it and we'll explain it, and then we'll go into it in a little greater detail. Amalahem HaMemuneh, this is the head of the shift of Kohanim. They are entering the Beis HaMikdash for the first time during the day, very early in the morning. And so he calls out to them, Baruch Hu Bracha Achas, recite one bracha, Behem Baruch Hu. And they recite the bracha. We don't know yet what that bracha is. Kiru Aseres HaDvarim, read the Aseres HaDibros, Shema V'Hayom Shemoa, Vayomer, read the three parashos of Kriya Shema. Baruch Hu Es Ha'am, Shalosh Brachos, bless the people with three blessings. Emes V'Yatziv, Avoda, which is the Baruch Hu Ritzei, and Birkas Kohanim. Here we're not talking about the actual Birkas Kohanim. The Kohanim of the Beit HaMikdash did not perform the actual Birkat Kohanim until after they had brought the Korban Tumid. We are talking about them first, literally just walking into the Beit HaMikdash before doing any of the Avoda. They haven't even taken, they used to divide the jars by lottery. They haven't done any of that. They just walked in and they are reciting these sections of the davening. So they are, for Birkas Kohanim, they are reciting the bracha of Sim Shalom. Let me begin by talking a little bit about the Kohanim, particularly since we're just before Hanukkah, and the Kohanim played a very important role in Hanukkah. So I can teach you a little bit about Hanukkah, maybe some things you didn't know, maybe some things that you didn't want to know. The Kohanim were divided into 24 shifts, 24 mishmarot. They were based on geographical districts. Israel was divided into 24 districts, and each district had a group of Kohanim, and they would come to the Beit HaMikdash to serve for a week at a time, so that your average Kohen would work approximately 2 weeks a year in the Beit HaMikdash. You might be wondering, what did the Kohanim do the other 50 weeks of the year? Well, what the Kohanim did were, they really had the place of the rabbinate. They were the judges, the dayanim. They were the halachic decision makers, and they were the teachers, so they basically fulfilled what would today be considered functions of the rabbinate. So this raises a very important question. When you study the transmission of the Masorah in Pirkei Avos tells us, Moshe kibel Torah Mesinai, Moshe received the Torah at Mount Sinai, umasru al Yehoshua, and turned it over to Yehoshua. Yehoshua was Canaan to the elders, was Canaan the Nevi'im, and then the Nevi'im to the prophets, and then the prophets to Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the great assembly. This one line, in the beginning of Maseches Avos, covers the transmission of the Torah for about approximately 1,000 years. I'm telling you now that the Kohanim were part of their responsibility was the transmission of Torah. Why in Pirkei Avos aren't they given any credit? Why do we hear about the Zekanim? Why do we hear about the Nevi'im? Why do we hear about Anshei Knesset Gdola? But we don't hear about the Kohanim. And that's, there was two reasons that Chazal developed a little bit of a negative attitude towards the Kohanim. Number one, the Kohanim, it appears, kept Torah learning for themselves as their own field of study, and were not opening up the field of study to others other than the Kohanim. They were keeping it as their own area of study. And I believe that the reason why the first person who's mentioned after Anshei Knesset Gdola is Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik was the Kohen Gadol of his time. And he's the first one listed because after him, we start to get people who were not Kohanim in the chain of Mesorah. And I believe it was Shimon HaTzadik recognized because of what was going on in Israel, which was Alexander the Great had conquered Israel, and Greek culture came in with Alexander the Great. And so the upper classes of the Jewish community were starting to be attracted to Hellenism. Among that group were the Kohanim. Apparently the Kohanim were in the upper income group. As you all know, they received 24 matanos. They were entitled to 24 gifts, some that they would receive when they served in the Beit HaMikdash, some they would receive outside of the Beit HaMikdash, like Truma, like Maaseh Truma, and they were always redeeming firstborn. So if Kohanim lived among farmers and successful farmers who had a lot of animals, who were giving birth to firstborn animals, the Kohanim could do rather well in the pidyon business. So I believe that the Kohanim were among those who were influenced by Hellenism. So I think the Chazal, in the end, was somewhat critical of the Kohanim for keeping the Torah as their private area of study, and because they were influenced by Hellenism. And one of the main reasons I know that they were influenced by Hellenism is the fact that we developed this rift between the Tzukim and the Prushim, between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. This was part of the difficulties that lay, that were in the Jewish community before the Hanukkah story. And who are the Tzukim named after? Who was Tzadok? Tzadok was the family from whom the Kohen Gadol came. The job of Kohen Gadol was a job that was passed on from father to son. In other words, a Kohen Gadol, when he died, his elder son took over. It was something that stayed in the family. I believe that the first family that was granted the job of Kohen Gadol was the family of Pinchas. That was one of the, that was what God awarded him because he interfered when one of the heads of one of the tribes committed an immoral act publicly with one of the Midianite women. And he was given a special gift, and that was to be Kohen Gadol. So his family was the family from whom the Kohen Gadol was descended. That continued until the time of David HaMelech. David HaMelech, as he's lying in his deathbed, calls in King Shlomo, and he tells King Shlomo, number one, to get rid of his general, Yoav, and secondly, to get rid of Ebiathar, and to transfer the job of Kohen Gadol from the family of Pinchas to the family of Tzadok. So Tzadok starts out as a good guy, and his family is the family from whom the Kohen Gadol is chosen right through until the Hanukkah story. One of the results of the victory of the Hashmonaim is they took over as kings. They established an independent monarchy. So they took the role of king away from the house of David, and they kept it for themselves. And the second thing they kept was the job of Kohen Gadol. So after the Hashmonaim were victorious, the Kohen Gadol no longer came from the family of Tzadok. It came from the family of the Hashmonaim. Unfortunately, the Hashmonaim, after they're victorious and after they become kings, also become influenced from Hellenism, and eventually their descendants start to bicker, and they invite Rome into Eretz Yisrael, And of course, Rome does not like to be a guest. It wants to be the host. So Rome slowly takes over. You have the rebellion, and then you have the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So you can draw almost a straight line from the victory of Hanukkah to the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. That's not to say that if the Hashmonaim were not victorious, we would have been better off. I have a feeling if the Hashmonaim had not been victorious, the Jewish people would no longer have existed. So, and we know that we've been able to exist without the second Beit HaMikdash. I'm not so sure we would have continued to exist if the Hashmonaim had not been victorious during the time of the Hanukkah story. So that's my little Hanukkah Torah that I wanted to share with you. This week, since tomorrow night, we're going to begin celebrating Hanukkah. But let's go back to this Mishnah. So the head of the shift called out to everybody to recite a bracha. What's significant to me here is the fact that he's called out Boruchu. And I really think that this is the source for our practice of reciting Boruchu before Birchos Kriya Shema and Kriya Shema. This is what the Kohanim did. The chief Kohen from that shift called out Boruchu, and they went ahead and recited Birchos Kriya Shema and Kriya Shema. I also think this is the source for reciting Boruchu before Kriyas HaTorah. One of the important lessons about Tefillah is the fact that we have so much Limud Torah embedded within Tefillah. And the question is, why do we have so much Limud Torah? If you think about it, we have Karbonos, and we have Kriya Shema, and we have Sukkot Zimra. We have many, many paragraphs, many chapters, many psukim from the Torah intertwined within the davening. Why? And to me, the answer is that both Tefillah and Limud Torah really represent the same act, and that is Avodah Shebelev. It's service of the heart, and in very many ways, they are interchangeable. As a matter of fact, I'd like to recommend to anyone who belongs to a Tehillim group, particularly women who belong to a Tehillim group, that perhaps they should consider, instead of just reciting chapter after chapter of Tehillim, where there are many words and many lines that they do not understand, perhaps it would be better if they would read fewer paragraphs of Tehillim and explain them, so that everyone in the room at least understands what they're saying. I think if they're praying for someone who's sick, who needs parnasa, who needs a shidduch, or every reason that they're saying Tehillim, I think it would be much more meaningful if they would learn Tehillim, keeping in mind that learning Torah and Tefillah may be just, twins of each other. And so they are accomplishing Tefillah by learning the chapters of Tehillim. So here, Kriya Shema, every pasuk that we recite during davening serves two purposes. It's part of Tefillah, but it's also Limud Torah. So I think when the Mamuna, when that shift, head of the shift called out, Kiru Aseres HaDvarim, he was basically, it's like Kriyas HaTorah. He was asking them to read it. And therefore, again, I think that's why the practice began to say Boruchu before Kriyas HaTorah. What is this bracha that they recited? The Gemara asked that question. The Gemara says it could not have been the bracha of Yotzeh HaMa'orot, because you need to have the sun actually visible in the sky before you can say the bracha of Yotzeh HaMa'orot. So they say this must be the bracha of Ahava Rabba. It also makes sense that it should be the bracha of Ahava Rabba, because the bracha of Ahava Rabba serves as a Birchas HaTorah. So that would be appropriate before reading the Aseres HaDibros and the Parshas of Kriya Shema, which serving, as I say, both as Tefillah and as Limud Torah, that you would say a Birchas HaTorah. So that's the bracha that they said. What's the three brachas that they recited after Kriya Shema? Emes V'yatziv, which ends with Goal Yisrael. Again, the period of the second Beis HaMikdash was a very tumultuous period. Most of the time, there was very good reason to pray the prayer of Goal Yisrael. The independent Jewish monarchy lasted for a very short time. And so, this Mishnah could be talking about the Roman occupation, or could be talking even about the time of the Seleucid occupation. There was a reason to say the bracha of Goal Yisrael. What about the bracha of Avodah? In Ritzei, we say Amachazir Shechinah Sol Tzion. That doesn't seem to be an appropriate bracha to make while the Beit HaMikdash is standing, and I suspect they did not. They recited the Bracha Vertzei as we found it last week in Minhag Eretz Yisrael, which is She'oz Cholavadcha B'Yiran Avot, the same Bracha that we recite in Musa Shmona Esrei for Modim when we have Birkas Kohanim. That isn't appropriate. Particularly in a period where you have Hellenism, where you have Roman occupation, where there is a lot of idolatry going along, this is a true blessing to make. She'ozcha, that you should be the only one that we serve. So that, I believe, was the Bracha of Avoda, and Berkas Kohen, as I explained to you before, was probably Sim Shalom. The significance of this Mishnah and the relationship it is to the Sidur that I showed you before, I bet you thought I was never going to get to it, is the fact that Aseres Hadibros was put on the same level as Kriyat Shema. And this makes perfect sense. If you're going to pick a part of the Torah to recite every day, shouldn't it be the part of the Torah that the Jewish people heard at Mount Sinai from the voice of the Ribbono Shel Olam himself? This is our source for the fact that the Torah is valid. That was the revelation that we had in Har Sinai. The Ribbono Shel Olam spoke to the people, and it was through the Aseres Hadibros. So you would think, of all things that we're going to recite from the Torah, shouldn't it be Aseres Hadibros? And that is the truth. This is a very significant change that took place in davening, almost at its before even davening began, that they did not continue the practice of reciting Aseres Hadibros. What's the reason that they did not continue to recite Aseres Hadibros? That's found in source number 2. The Gemara repeats this Mishnah, and then it says, Omar Rav Yehuda, Omar Shmuel, Af Begulim Bikshu Likros Kain, Elishvar Bitlum Ipnei Tarovas Aminim. They wanted to establish the practice of reciting Aseres Hadibros every day as part of davening, but they had already eliminated it. They had already taken it out of davening because of the influence of the apostates. Let's look at Rashi to understand what we're talking about. That's source number 3. Bikshu, the Boa Aseres Hadibros with Kriyat Shema. They wanted to establish the recital of Aseres Hadibros in the Berachos Kriyat Shema, like the Kohanim used to recite when they first came into the Beit HaMikdash. Why didn't they? Bipnei Tairovas Aminim, Shlo Yomru Lame Oritz. They didn't want these apostates to say to the ignorant people, Ein Shar Torah MS, the rest of the Torah is not true. The Tedu Shein Korin El Masham HaKadosh Baruch Hu Hashamu Mipim B'Sinai. They did not want the apostates to convince the ignorant people, the people who are not learned, that the only part of the Torah that's valid is the part that the Jewish people heard at Mount Sinai. Who are these apostates? That's again Rashi Akum. And then we have this note from the Bar Ilan CD, Ashmotas Asanzura, meaning the censor took out what was originally written in Rashi, and that was Talmidei Yeshu, the students of Jesus. So we're talking here about the Christians. And for this, I should share with you just a little bit about Christian theology, and I'm actually sharing with you all I know about Christian theology. And apparently, Christian theology believed that due to the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, the Ribbono Shel Olam punished the Jewish people. How did he punish the Jewish people? By giving them the 613 mitzvot. We look upon the 613 mitzvot as a gift. The Christians look upon it as a punishment. That we have to follow all these rules as a punishment. And they argue that with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and with the death of Jesus, the Jewish people were finally forgiven for the sins of the golden calf. Therefore, the Jews no longer had to follow the 613 mitzvot. Instead, all they had to follow were the Ten Commandments. And as you know, the Christians accept all of the Ten Commandments. They apparently keep it. They keep Shabbos, but they call it on Sunday. But they keep the Aseres Hadibros. And the argument they make, that's the only part that is still valid today because of the fact that's the only part of davening which the only part of the Torah which the Jews heard directly from the Ribbono Shel Olam. So because Chazal were concerned that this argument would be used by the Christians against the Jewish theology, they eliminated the Aseres HaDibros from davening and did not allow it to be reestablished. What's interesting is what we see happening almost immediately. You have the Talmud Yerushalmi, and the Talmud Yerushalmi here says, it's source number 4, "Mipnei ma korin shtei parshas halol v'chol yom," and it's an interesting question. They're talking about Kriya Shema, and they're prefacing it by saying it only has 2 parsha. Well, in Eretz Yisrael, certainly at night, they did not say the parsha of Ayomer, but they did say it in the morning. So, Rav Simon Amar Neshikosu Behem Shkiva Akima, so someone says you must recite those 2 parshas of Kriya Shema because they have in there that we're supposed to say it when we arise in the morning and when we get up, when we get up in the morning and when we go to sleep at night. And there are Levi Omer Mipnei Shaseres Hadibros Klulamahem. Rabbi Levi says it's because you can find the Aseres Hadibros within Kriya Shema. So what you saw in that Sidur from Livorno in the early 1900s, the placement of the words, the opening words of the Aseres Hadibros before certain sections of the Shema represent this Gemara, which explains, and I'm not going to go through it line by line, I'll let you do it at your own leisure, and you can compare it to the Siddur from Livorno, and you'll see that it matches almost exactly. Exactly where, whatever the Talmud Yerushalmi says, that the words of the Aseres Hadibros appear in Kriya Shema, that's the way it's laid out in the Siddur in Livorno. Let's now jump ahead to the time of Shulchan Aruch, and the Shulchan Aruch has something to say about this whole issue of reciting the Aseres Hadibros. That's source number 5. And he has it right away. It's Siman Aleph. It's the first Siman of Aruch Hayim. Siv Hei, Tov Lomar, Parshas Keda. It's good to say the Parshas Keda in the morning. Uparshas Hamon, the story of the Mon. The Aseres Hadibros. He's recommending that we recite Aseres Hadibros in the morning. Uparshas Ola, Umincho, Shlomim, V'chatas V'osham. So, the Siddur we looked at from Livorno follows the Sephardic Minhag. And the Sephardic Minhag is to recite Aseres Hadibros as part of davening. So you see the connection. You will not find those same inserts in an Ashkenazic Siddur. I have yet to see an Ashkenazic Siddur that puts those inserts into Kriya Shema, and you'll see why, because the Ramah was giving us the Ashkenazic point of view, says right away, V'dafka b'yochad mutar lomar Aseres Hadibros v'chol yom. Only an individual is allowed when he davens alone to include the Aseres Hadibros somewhere in the davening. Aval asur la'omrim b'tzibur. It is not permitted to recite the Aseres Hadibros as part of any part of davening, whether in the beginning of davening or the end of davening, if it is a public prayer service. And the Mishnah Brura continues with it. He says, "Mipnei ha'kofrim." The reason why we don't say, in other words, he's commenting on the Ramah's position, because of the Christians, Shiyomarin Torah Elazu, because I'll say that this is the only part of the Torah which is so valid. Uprat is my name. He says it's a particular problem in our own time. Lakach and Kosvin also Gamken of Kuntres of Yucha Letzibur. There is a prohibition, believe it or not, to print a booklet with just the Aseres Hadibros in it. Again, for the exact same reason. We don't want to give ammunition to the Christian world to be able to say, look, this booklet proves that we are correct, that only the Aseres Hadibros of all the mitzvahs in the Torah still apply today. And the Mishnah Brura continues, Yesh Yekasur La'osu La'omer B'tzibur, El'akavu V'nebrachos Mo Kriya Shema. He said there's some who wrote that the only prohibition is to recite it like the Kohanim used to recite it, right before Kriya Shema, Aval Kodim Bar Shoma Mutar, and this is something you will find if you search hard enough. You will find, again, among Sephardim, that they would recite the Aseres Hadibros before Baruch Shomar, Ap B'tzibur, even in Shul, Anan Naktina, Lesser B'tzibur, Klal, the Klal, the Yochid, Dafka, Shalom, Tov HaTfila, Lekol, Tov HaBrochos, Kam, the Yochid, Asur. She says, yes, Yochid can say it, but not among the brachos. There actually is a corollary problem that's covered by this same rule, and that is, should we or should we not stand up for the reading of the Aseres HaDibros and Kriyas HaTorah, and Parshas Yisro, and Parshas Vaschanan, and when we read it on Shavuos? Should we stand up? And the main reason given for not standing up is, again, once you give preference to this section of the Torah by standing up, well, you are giving ammunition to the Christian world to say, look, they stand up only for this section of the Torah. This supports our position that only this part of the Torah came from Sinai, is the only valid part of the Torah. What I'd like to do now is turn to a different issue, and that concerns Birkas Kohanim, and the whole question as to why among Ashkenazim they do not have a Kohanim perform Birkas Kohanim every day of the year. And so the earliest answer to this question I found in source number 7. Let me turn on my pointer. This is a Sefer Igor. It's from the 1400s. His father was a student of the Maharil. Nishal Godol Hador Mahari Molin. The Maharil was asked the question, Loma in a Kohanim Nosen Kafeim B'chol Yom Ma'achas Shul Mitzvahs Aseh. He was asked, why don't the Kohanim bench the people every day? After all, it is a Mitzvahs Aseh. The Heshiv. So again, we're going to see three answers given. Mipnei Shehu Minhag HaKohanim Litbo Kodem. It is the custom among Kohanim to go to the mikveh before they recite Birkas Kohanim. Kamosha Kosu Behegos Maimonides, like it's written in one of the commentaries to the Rambam. Ubechol Yom Kosher Lehem Litbo L'Chorev. It's hard for them to do that because Ashkenazic countries, it was very cold. There's the same reason given why the Hasidim do not eat in the Sukkah on Shmini Atzeres at night, because it was cold, cold in Sukkot. And so it's given here as the reason why Kohanim did not duchen in Ashkenazic countries, because they couldn't go to the mikvah. So only on Yom Tov, because if you think about it, Sukkot and Pesach, it's generally warmer. I just told you the opposite. I said that in Hasidic communities it was colder, but whatever. Apparently, at that time, he's saying that it was not that cold that they could go to the mikvah. The Gami Tam Bito Malocha. This is an interesting reason. It's because they're going to lose time from their work. This is not the only place where you'll find this reason why some things were eliminated from Nusach Ashkenaz. And it really points out a little bit of a difference between the circumstances under which the Sfardim found themselves and the circumstances under which Ashkenazim found themselves. I think overall, the Sephardim feared better with their government, under their Islamic government, than the Jews feared under Christianity. And Jews constantly were being either thrown out of countries or thrown out of cities or forced to convert much greater extent than the Sfardim. Even in Spain, Gerer Sfara was not because of Islam. Gerer Sfara, the expulsion from Spain, was because Spain had become Christian. And so I think that the Jews felt a need to work any chance they could, because they didn't know if that was going to be the last day they could work, and they were going to be asked to leave that night. And so you do see this reason of Bitul Malacha, of being, losing time from work. I only see it in Ashkenazi commentators. I have not seen it among the Sfardim. And the last reason is also a fascinating reason. Ukeshe HaKohen Eino Nikra, Eino Ober. What this means is, if the Kohanim are not called to go to the Duchen, they are not supposed to go. What is the Sefer Igor referring to? The Gemara does say, I didn't bring it down here, but the Gemara does say that when there are more than two Kohanim, the Kohanim must be called. The Levush describes it in two ways. He says, at a minimum, someone should call out for the Kohanim to go out to wash their hands before they daven. And that calling to the Kohanim to go wash their hands serves as the call for the Kohanim to go up to the daven. But then he also adds that some have the custom of doing it again before duchening, and that's the better way to conduct themselves. At my synagogue, Young Israel Hillcrest, our former Morad Asra was a Kohen, Rabbi Simcha Kraus, and when the Shliach Tzibur would reach the words for Hoshev Kohanim La'avodosam, just before Ritzei, in the Shmona Esrei from Musa, he would call out Kohanim. He would already be on, he would be back in his seat, he would have washed his hands, he was back in his seat on the Bima, and he would call out Kohanim. And I realized that that was his way of complying with this rule that the Kohanim have to be called. Rabbi Kraus retired, and after he left, we started to have a little bit of a rift. There were some Kohanim like myself, I took it upon myself to call out Kohanim, and I would go up after we said those words. There were other Kohanim who wanted to wait for Ritzei. And so I made it a point the next time we saw Rabbi Kraus at a simcha to find as many people in the Young Israel Hillcrest as I could and ask him, did he really mean that in order to fulfill this requirement of calling? And he said, absolutely. That is the way he wanted to fulfill the requirement that you have to call the Kohanim. I gave a talk on this subject at a Pesach program about 2 years ago, and I was very happy that after I finished, a gentleman came up to me, and he said he lives in Chicago, and he acts a Shliach Tzibur quite frequently, particularly on Yontif, and he makes it a point of saying Hashem Kohanim Bavodosom in a way that the Kohanim understand it's a signal for them to get up. And so I was glad to hear that I wasn't following a Das Yochid, the opinion of one person. I know now that there are people in Chicago who also believe that the words Hoshe Kohanim Lavodosom should be used as a call to the Kohanim. I gave this talk again in Young Israel Hillcrest over Sukkos, and several people who originally lived in Eretz Yisrael came over to me and said, you know, we duchened every morning and we don't remember anybody calling the Kohanim to come forward. So it's an interesting issue, but you see the Sefer Igor is giving this idea that if you don't call a Kohen, he doesn't come up, as being the reason that the Ashkenazim did not recite Birkas Kohanim. So I guess the answer to those people from Israel would be as well, look, if the Kohanim came up on their own, there's no harm. Nothing was wrong with the Kohanim going up on their own, but perhaps the better way is if they could figure out some way. I don't see what the big deal that the Gabbai should just say Kohanim just before it say and have them go up. How about the whole issue of do you have to go to mikvah? I'm a Kohen. So this is an issue which is very dear to me. I don't go to the mikvah before Sukkos, before Pesach. So is there a requirement to go to the mikvah? Well, that's source number 8. The Gemara raises this. The only requirement for a Kohen is that he washes hands. As a matter of fact, I was sitting with a buddy of mine. I call him my Siddur Chavrusa, Rabbi Jack Kaufman from Young Israel Hillcrest, who's been studying the Siddur a lot longer than me. And he raised the issue of when did the practice start for the Levim to start washing the hands of the Kohanim. And so we all, about 4 or 5 of us, started doing some research, and we found the answer that actually comes from the Zohar. So this is another one of the tikkunim that the Mekubalim of Tzfat came up with, that a Levi should go out with the Kohanim and wash the Kohanim's hands. Let's now go to source 9, and we're going to see a totally different answer to this whole problem. This answer comes from the Sefer Matan Moshe. If you're not familiar with the Sefer Matan Moshe, you should make yourself familiar. He was a student of Rav Shlomo Luria. It's a very important Sefer. It's really a fun Sefer. It's not a very big Sefer. It follows more or less the Or Chaim. But he has some comments in there that I have seen nowhere else. And this is one of them. He talks about Birkas Kohanim and why it was not performed every day among Ashkenazim, and he gives a totally different answer. V'yesha kosuv b'nei agoyim. He says it's because of the non-Jews. Ki b'yesh mekomos ein manichim shem goy v'eis hadochen. He said there are places where they don't allow non-Jews to remain in the shul during davening. This whole issue of non-Jews being present in shul, I've seen mentioned in other books, particularly in Lee Levine's book on the ancient synagogue, without an explanation. And I really, this is again, if somebody has time and wants to research this, you know, what prompted there to be non-Jews present in synagogue? Were they curious? Were they considering conversion? I really don't know the reason why, but apparently this is not unusual that non-Jews would be present during davening. And so the Matan Moshe is saying is that they would chase the non-Jews out during davening. So apparently they didn't want to do it every day. If they didn't want to do it every day of the year. So the question is, why would they be chasing non-Jews out during davening? And for this, we're going to look at two Mishnayos. They're really the exact same sugya, one according to the Talmud Bavli and one according to the Talmud Yerushalmi. There's really only one little difference. Let's start with the Bavli, which is source number 11. Maase Ruvein Nikrov Lo Mitargim. This is a reference to the practice that used to exist, that after the Baal Kori would read a pasuk, there would be a mitorgamon. There would be somebody who would translate the pasuk. So the Mishnah is telling us that there are certain rules that apply to certain sections of the Torah. So Maase Ruvein, that's a story with Ruvein and Bilhah, the concubine of Yaakov. It can be read but not translated. Maase Tomo Nikro Mitargim. You can read and you can translate the story of Tomor, which we read recently in the Torah reading. Maase Egel Arisha Nikro Mitargim, the story of the sin of the Egel, which is reported in Sefer Shmos, you can read and you can translate, but not the second one, the one that's in Sefer Devarim. Birkas Kohanim, Maase David V'yamno, Nikro'in, V'lo Mitargimina. You can read it, but you cannot translate it. If you go up and look at source 10, just on this section here, Birkas Kohanim lo nikra'o v'lo mitargimino. In Eretz Yisrael, they would skip Birkas Kohanim, not to translate it, they wouldn't read it as well. Which brings up a few issues. Number one, is there a requirement, as part of Kriyas HaTorah, that we read every pasuk in the Torah? Is it like Megillas Esther, that if you miss one pasuk, you didn't fulfill your obligation? Apparently, this Mishnah is saying no. You can skip Birkas Kohanim. Why did they skip Birkas Kohanim? It may be related to something we spoke about last week, which was that Chazal in Eretz Yisrael were opposed to the practice in Babylonia of reading, of having the Shliach Tzibur read Birkas Kohanim and Elokeinu Elokei Avoseinu Melechem Avraham Shleshes. So they had a rule that only a Kohen could read it. So they didn't want a Yisrael to read it, and it could turn out that would fall into the a Sidra that a Yisrael would have to read. Even though they give a different reason here, they see here, my time up, because it says, Kosovorku, because the Torah tells us, these psukim are supposed to be used for a blessing, lebracha nitna v'lo nitna l'kriya. They're not meant for reading, they're meant for a blessing, so you can skip them. But the question that I have is, why not? What is wrong with translating the psukim of Birkas Kohanim? So the Gemara asks the question. That's in source number 11. Birkas Kohanim Nikrim Lo Mitargiminan. You can read the psukim of Birkas Kohanim. Again, this is the Babylonian practice. V'lo mitargimina, my time, what's the reason? Mishum desiv yisof. Because we find in Birkas Kohanim the word yisof. What is so special about the word yisof that we don't want to translate it? Oops. Bring it down. Let me use this. Sorry. Oh, okay. What's wrong with the word Yisa? Rashi explained, Mishum Yisa Shelo Yomru. Who's the Shelo Yomru? The non-Jews shouldn't say. HaKadosh Baruch Hu no say lahen ponim. What does the word Yisa mean? It means favor. The Kohanim are asking the Ribono Shel Olam to favor the Jewish people. Yisa Hashem ponav eilecha v'yaseim lecha shalom. Favor the Jewish people, so the non-Jews shouldn't say, look at the Jews, they're asking God to favor them. This would cause a problem for the non-Jews. They would get upset and that they would start to persecute, start a fight with the Jews if they would hear this. And Rashi says, Ein Yodin Shekatai Hen Yisrael says Lempon. And he says, but the non-Jews don't realize that there's very good reason why God should be favoring the Jewish people. So what's the upshot of all this? The upshot of this is the reason why they didn't translate it is because there might be non-Jews present who may not understand the Hebrew, but they understand the Aramaic, the translation, and so they didn't want those people to hear the Baal Koreh read that the Kohanim would ask the Ribono Shel Olam to favor the Jewish people because it might cause trouble for the community. So this is like a case of self-censorship, which is a major theme of the history of the Siddur, self-censorship. And I think that later even in Ashkenazic communities, again, this is the difference between Ashkenazic communities and Sephardic communities. I think that Jews were more concerned. Jews actually had this self-censorship in Ashkenazic communities. I haven't seen it in Sephardic communities. And so I think that they were concerned about non-Jews being present. Now, what kind of non-Jews were they really concerned with? I think they were concerned with Mishumadim. Mishumadim are those Jews who converted to Catholicism. And as we all know, there's nothing worse than a recent convert to Christianity because he wants to be more Christian than the Christians and he wants to snitch on the Jewish people. So if the Ashkenazi Jews would recite Birkas Kohanim every day, there would be the possibility that the Mishumadim would bring their Christian friends into shul with them and then say to them, do you know what, do you see the Kohanim standing up there? They're putting the talus over their head. Look at this grand ceremony. This whole grand ceremony is because they want to ask God to favor the Jews over the Christians. And this could have caused difficulties for the Jewish community. So I think one of the bases for the Ashkenazi community not instituting the practice of reciting a Birkas Kohanim every day was out of concern for possibility the Christians hearing about it and using it as a weapon to persecute the Jewish community. So this is, again, another practice that may have been influenced, like the elimination of Aseres HaDibros from the davening, also the fact that in Ashkenazi community they did not recite Birkas Kohanim. I'm finally going to say, okay. Anyway, for those of you who want to continue, I had one more area that I wanted to discuss. So if you don't mind, for another 10 minutes. And it begins with a question about the bracha of Machayeh HaMeisim. And the question I have about the bracha of Machayeh HaMeisim is, when you study the bracha, the second bracha of Shemona Esrei, which is called Gevurot, it's a description of the great acts of kindness that the Ribono Shel Olam performs on a regular basis. We have acts in there that we're quite familiar with, things that we've witnessed. We've witnessed Mashiv Aruch HaMorev Hashem. You know, we've witnessed the rain. We've witnessed Mechal Kachayim, providing food for people. Rofei Cholim, healing the sick. Matir Asurim. The one power, or the one act of kindness that God performs that we're not familiar with, that we have not witnessed, is Machayeh HaMeisim. So the question I have is, why did Chazal pick that power of God, or that act of kindness of God, to be the main theme of the bracha? Because it's in the Chasimus of bracha. We say, Baruch Atah Hashem Chaya Mason, it's because it is the key kindness, act of kindness, that God performs for us. So why did Chazal pick that of all those powers to name the bracha after? And you also see the words Mechayim Esim appear 3 or 4 times in the bracha. So the answer, I believe, is that this was enacted, composed, to be an anti-Sadducee, an anti-Stukim bracha. The Stukim did not accept Torah Shavuot Peh, nor did they accept the power of Chazal to derive from the Torah. And so, in order to reinforce the validity of Torah Shavuot Peh, and to reinforce the power that Chazal have to derive laws from the practices from the Torah, Chazal had the community assert 3 times a day that we believe God has the power to give life to the deceased. So to me, this bracha was enacted for those 2 reasons, to verify the authenticity of Torah Shavuot Peh, and also to confirm the power that Chazal has. We see this again at another period of history, during the period of the Gaonim, and this is in reaction to a very similar attack on Rabbinic Judaism, and that is the Karaite movement. The Karaite movement begins in the mid-700s in Babylonia. It starts in a very unusual way. There was a family where there were 2 sons. Both sons were in line to become the next Gaon, the next head of the yeshiva. When it came time to pick the Gaon, they ended up picking the younger one over the older one. So the older one, was known as Anan ben David, decides, I'm going to get even with Chazal. I'm starting my own religion. I'm starting the Karaite movement, and the whole theology of the Karaite movement is that it only accepts the written Torah. It does not accept Torah Shavuot Peh, very similar to the position of the Stukim. One of the big divides between the Karaim and the followers of the Rabbanim was having light on Shabbos. Most people, if you ask them what they know about the Karaite movement, they'll tell you, well, the Karaites sit at home on Shabbos, and they sit in the dark on Shabbos. And that's true. They take the pasuk Lo Tzavaru Esh B'Sof HaTechem on Shabbos as meaning that you cannot have even a fire burning on Shabbos, even if the fire had been set prior to Shabbos. And Chazal say that prohibition is only to lighting a new fire, but as long as you set up the fire before Shabbos, you can benefit from that fire. So what did Chazal do to reinforce again? They wanted to reinforce that that it's permitted, you know, that they have the Mesorah passed down to them that you're allowed to have a fire burning on Shabbos, and again to ratify the fact that Chazal can derive these rules from the Torah. They enacted the practice of reciting a bracha for Hadlakas Neros. If you look in the Gemara, you will not find the bracha for lighting candles on Shabbos. And the fact that Chazal, the Gaonim, instituted the practice of reciting this bracha is a major act because, as I think I mentioned earlier, we have a rule that we're not supposed to be reciting brachos that are not mentioned in the Gemara. That this was a time of great need. Apparently, there was something attractive about the theology of the Karaites. I haven't exactly been able to figure out exactly what made their point of view so appealing, but apparently Chazal saw it as a tremendous threat against them. So that was one act that they instituted, and they purposely included Asher Kedishonu V'Zosav B'Tzivanu, which you would think would only be for a mitzvah and a Torah, but again, because of the urgency of the moment, and they wanted to confirm that Chazal have this power, they added Asher Kedishanu B'Zosav B'Tzivanu. So that's one one new practice that Chazal instituted, and they instituted a second one. And that is the recital of Bameh Madlikin. The chapter of Bameh Madlikin from Masechet Shabbos, we recite it every Friday night. You may have asked yourself the question once, why do we repeat the same Mishnah from Masechet Shabbos every week? Don't I know it already? I'm 57 years old, so if I started saying it when I was 7 years old, I've been saying it for 50 years, 52 times a year. I've been saying it over 2,500 times. Don't you think I know what it says? Particularly today when we can buy candles, kosher candles, in the store. Do I really need to review this particular chapter of Shabbos every week? Why don't we come up with a rotation? We'll start with the first Perek of Masechet Shabbos, and we'll divide up the Mishnayos from the whole Masechet Shabbos so that during the course of the year, we end up learning every Mishnah from Masechet Shabbos. And I think that that's something which the Kabbalim, I think you have it in the Siddur. Some people do that. They do review the Mishnayos of Masechet Shabbos during the course of the year, maybe even even on a single Shabbos. So why did Hazal pick this one section, this one chapter of Masechet Shabbos to repeat week after week? And that's because it dealt with the same issue of lighting candles on Shabbos. So again, they wanted to reinforce the idea that it is permitted to light candles before Shabbos and to be in a room that has light on Shabbos. Now, they also put it in a very interesting part of the davening. The original place where Bameh Madlikin was recited was at the end of davening. And that's still in the German Siddurim. If you look at the German Siddur, they recite Bameh Madlikin at the end of davening. And the way academic scholars view this is they saw this as an opportunity for the rabbi to get up and teach this chapter of Mishnayos of Shabbos, and with the purpose of trying to hear from the community if they were being influenced at all by Karaites. And so if anybody in the room was beginning to have any doubts about the rabbinic positions, Chazal wanted to hear it as soon as that doubt began so that they could answer any question anyone had that was based on Karaite theology and try to deflect it immediately and keep the people as followers of the rabbinic point of view. So that's what they instituted at the beginning of Shabbos. They also instituted practices towards the end of Shabbos and Milchatai. They instituted a practice of saying it's at Koscha Tzedek, three psukim that are considered Tzedek Adin, is where we say that we accept whatever God has decided to do. It's the same thing that a person, similar to what a person recites, unfortunately, when he has to bury a loved one. And the reason we give is because Moshe Rabbeinu apparently died on a Shabbos afternoon at Mincha time. So we are telling the Ribbono Shel Olam, we accept the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu had to die, because we believe if Moshe Rabbeinu had not died, then Jews would never have been thrown out of Eretz Israel, the Beis Hamikdash would never have been destroyed, it would have been the equivalent of the Mashiach coming. So we recite these psukim to commemorate the death of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Gaonim say that we do something else to commemorate the death of Moshe Rabbeinu, and that's to read Pirkei Avot. And they say you're supposed to read Pirkei Avot every Shabbos afternoon, not just like in our practices, which is just between Pesach and Shavuos, and something to do between Pesach and Rosh Hashanah. The Gaonim say you have to recite it every Shabbos. And they give it based on the reason that Moshe Rabbeinu was the head of the yeshiva. And when the head of the yeshiva dies, the yeshiva is supposed to close down. Meaning there's not supposed to be any regular learning. So to commemorate the death of Moshe Rabbeinu, there should not be regular learning going on mincha time on Shabbos. What should we be doing? We should be remembering that Moshe kibel Torah Mesinai. So that's the reason given. There's just one problem. And that is when you do the calculation of the calendar, you realize that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't die on Shabbos afternoon. He died on a Friday afternoon. I'm not going to go through the calculation with you, but that's, you can find it among Chazal, and Chazal give different reasons or ways of explaining how it is that Moshe Rabbeinu died Shabbos afternoon, and yet we commemorate his death, on Friday afternoon, we commemorate his death on Shabbos afternoon. But academic scholars explain is that this was enacted as an anti-Karaite, again, another anti-Karaite practice. It's, again, to reinforce the idea that Moshe received not just the written law, but the oral law, and he passed the oral law onto Yehoshua, and Yehoshua to this Canaan, and this Canaan to Nevi'im, and then to the Anshe Knesset HaGdolah. So that's, again, an anti-Karaite movement. So here you have different practices over the centuries that have been enacted by Chazal that were enacted specifically to counteract influences that may have drawn people away from Rabbinic Judaism. Just as a footnote on the Karaite movement, they still exist today. If you Google them, you will find they have a large community in California. And then I found some interesting facts about them over the last 60, 70 years, particularly as concerned the Holocaust and the establishment of the State of Israel. Apparently, during the Holocaust, the Karaites claimed that they were not Jewish, and the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, did extensive research. They hired the best professors in all different areas to determine were the Karaites Jews or were the Karaites not Jews. And the conclusion that the Nazis came up with were that the Karaites were not Jews. So the Karaites were not shipped off to concentration death camps. They may, you know, they fared much better than the Jews. They were treated like all the other citizens. Jump ahead a few years with the establishment of the State of Israel. Guess who comes knocking on the door and asking to be recognized under the law of return? The Karaites. Now the Karaites are claiming, for purpose of the law of return, that they should be deemed to be Jewish. There's a whole halachic literature, tshuvas on this whole issue, whether the Karaites should be recognized as Jews or should not be recognized as Jews. Again, it's an interesting subject, an interesting footnote on the whole issue of the Karaite movement. Let me take this opportunity on anti-Karaite, is eating cholin. Okay, someone just posted that eating cholin is an anti-Karaite practice. I like that. That sounds good to me. It's also an anti-nutritional practice. I just want to express my thanks to those of you who came to each one or listened in on each one of the three lectures that I gave. I know I enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope I stirred some interest amongst you to study further the history of the Siddur. You're always welcome to visit my website, www.biraiatfila.com, or to email me. Perhaps we'll meet again on Torah Motion or elsewhere. I'll stay on for a few moments and see if anybody has any questions. Again, it was a pleasure, and please have a wonderful Hanukkah. Yeah, I keep forgetting. I keep forgetting that I can talk. You know, I gave you my answer. I started studying intensively about 9 years ago, but I learned about the whole field, but I was about 45 years ago. When I was in high school at Maimonides School in Brookline, you may not have been here for the first lecture when I described how Russell Soloveitchik, the late Robert Joseph Soloveitchik, who established Maimonides, gave his approval to having a class in Birkat Tefillah. The students had to study for an hour a week from grade 7 through grade 12. And it was the method that my Rabbi Yishai Wolgemutzek, etc., used of looking for sources, always looking for sources. And since then, I've realized that there are many, many, many more sources available to us today. I described two of them earlier, using digital libraries. I think it's just fantastic, the fact that we can search the text, and we can also open up any of 44,000 Svarim at HebrewBooks.org. It's just such a pleasure what this young man has done. He's probably not a young man anymore in terms of uploading over 44,000 Svarim in every field of Jewish study. And just to open up a Masor from the 1500s, for me, there's no greater pleasure to seeing something different that they used to do, 500 years ago, 600 years ago, in the davening, and ask the question, why is it different? That's really the way you learn about tefillah, is when you ask the question, why are we doing things differently than our forefathers? And as we sort of touched upon it here with the Aseres HaDibros, that unfortunately we've never had the pleasure, the ability, the privilege actually, of reciting the Aseres HaDibros every day during davening, which really would have been a great treat for us. We just can't. It was taken away from us because of another religion. We just couldn't take the chance of having that theological argument. So to me, it's just, seeing these differences, whether it was from 2,000 years ago, 100 years ago, or even the Siddur we looked at from the early 1900s. Again, imagine opening up a Siddur and you see the words of Aseres HaDibros in the middle of Kriya Shema. Like, why? I mean, you're looking at it saying, why? Why would anybody do that? And there's an answer. The funny thing is that there's an answer. It's not always that easy to find the answers, but you can find the answers. Sometimes it takes, the answer will come weeks later, months later. That was the story with the Birkas Kohanim. I had written a whole article about Birkas Kohanim, and I mentioned the fact about the Matan Moshe saying that we don't do it because of the Goyim, but I didn't understand why. Couldn't find anybody give an explanation why, and I'm just speculating. It's because of it's the same reason why we can't translate it, is that the goyim shouldn't get upset because we're asking the Ribono Shalom to favor the Jewish people over them. That's the old chosen people argument. The non-Jews don't like when we're calling ourselves the chosen people. They want to know why we're chosen over them. Yes, I heard the Rav speak on a number of occasions. I'll have to be honest with you. I was a teenager and could not appreciate the scholarship of the Rav. I was too young, too immature, too busy with other things to really realize what I was missing. I did never hear him speak specifically about tefillah, but I did mention, or maybe I didn't mention, is that the Rav once the idea of giving a course in Birkat Tefillah was floated in Maimonides in the early 60s, the Rav gave his permission that they should do that, and he said he would devote the next year worth of talks to Tefillah. So apparently the Rav did spend one whole year with his Moshe Shabbos Shiurim speaking about Tefillah. Of course, I'm sorry that I never could not have heard it. I was much too young to appreciate it. However, I think if you ever get hold of Rabbi Wolgemuth's book, which is A Guide to Jewish Prayer, maybe I can pull it out quickly. I can find it in my library. Maybe you can see it. I'll put it up. This is it, A Guide to Jewish Prayer. I like to say that this is not the way Rabbi Wolgemuth taught tefillah to us. He taught it to us from a source base. I believe that this book incorporates what the Rav spoke about that one year that he devoted to tefillah. So if you want to have some idea, and he does quote the Rav pretty regularly in this book. If you get your hands on it, it's out of print. I hope someday to help sponsor the publication of this book again, so be available. I think that this book encapsulated what the Rav spoke about that year at Maimonides on the subject of tefillah. So it's if you can get your hands on this book, it'll be worthwhile. I have looked at the book Worship of the Heart. I can't say again. I have my method of studying, which is asking the question why, you know, when and why. And many of the Gedolim, when they talk about tefillah, don't like that approach. They don't like the historical type of approach that I like. I understand why they don't like it. They don't want to introduce history. I'm not saying they're wrong. I enjoy it. I think that there's a lot of validity to it. I think we learn a lot about tefillah from it. I think there's room in the under the umbrella of Torah to study both the way the Gedolim study and the way that academic scholars study it. I think there's plenty of room for both, particularly in the area of tefillah. I've never read anything that I thought was apikorsis when it came to tefillah. As a matter of fact, there are books I recommend that were written by women Reform rabbis, believe it or not, because again, it's looking at tefillah from a historic point of view. They're not talking about reforming the Siddur. They're talking about tefillah. They just happen to be Reform rabbis, but they are writing, looking at tefillah from a historical point of view. So again, that's just the way, that's my approach. I understand it's not for everybody, and I think that's the reason why I haven't been invited to teach in any yeshiva, because I don't know if they're ready to have their students have a Rebbe or a teacher teaching them Mishnah Gemara from a historical point of view. I agree with 100% Yisrael, and you can take some of my newsletters and bring it. The children are in yeshiva. Bring them over to the principal and see what he thinks. Alberto raises a good question. I haven't thought of comparing the two. It might quite possibly be that the blessing on the Hanukkah candles, again, they serve a totally different purpose. Remember that. The Shabbos candles really for utilitarian purpose. So I can understand why Chazal would not need a bracha. We don't make a bracha when we set our timers before Shabbos, or we leave lights on before Shabbos. But that's what lighting Shabbos candles was. So I think that they didn't look at it necessarily as a religious act until they were threatened by the Karaites. I think that's probably what woke them up. Hanukkah is a different story. Hanukkah, we have the opposite rule. You can't use the lights of Hanukkah because they're special. So to have a bracha for Hanukkah candles, yes, it makes sense to me that the rule about lighting Hanukkah, make a bracha on Hanukkah candles is much older than the rule about making a bracha for Shabbos candles. Because again, they serve totally different purposes. And that's a good, you know, study, compare lighting Hanukkah candles with lighting Shabbos candles. I think you'll see that they are totally different, and it makes sense to me that you would make a bracha on Hanukkah candles sooner than you would make a bracha on Shabbos candles. But like I said, we don't make a bracha when we turn on the lights. We do it as part of our preparation for Shabbos, and yet we don't make a bracha on it. And that's what the Shabbos candles. They started out for a similar purpose. Correct? Yeah, this is what I like to say about the Rav and his practices. The Rav had his particular practices when it comes to davening. You see the Vilna Gaon has his book, Maaseh Rav. Vilna Gaon had his way. And that is the beauty of tefillah. It is flexible in that way that every gadol can recite, you know, tefillah the way that he believes that tefillah should be recited. One of the interesting, you know, we didn't have a chance to look at Aleinu. I was going to talk a little bit about Aleinu, but when I practiced this lecture, I realized that what I had was going to cover the hour. But there are sections of Aleinu that are controversial, and you find different versions of Aleinu Shabbat. People took things out because they were afraid that they were references to Jesus, to Muhammad, and also Moshe Yikaron. There's a problem with the Gematria. So, no, there's no question that individual Gedolim have their own way of davening. And I don't think that they necessarily advocate for their position. Just like, you know, again, who's the one who says that you should say Amhulol v'Teamo instead of Amhulol v'Teamo in the Bracha Bar Shama? It's the Mishnah Berurah. I mean, Atzrol leaned on the statement by the Mishnah Berurah when they changed the Bracha Bar Shamar in the Atzrol Sittah, according to Nusach Ashkenaz. And that was something that the Chofetz Chaim felt very strongly about, that you should say Amhulol v'Teamo. But again, there are tremendous arguments to say that you should say Amhulol v'Teamo. But that's the beauty. The beauty of tefillah is that when it's you and the Ribono Shel, you should express yourself in the way you're most comfortable with within the liturgy. There's certainly plenty of, what I always say is there's plenty of room for addition. And I think that's even a mistake we make. El-Kainetzor, which we say, is an example of an individual prayer that one of the Amoraim composed for himself. We've adopted it for ourselves. But it's really a signal. That's a moment when you should say, talk to God. And people should be encouraged. Talk to God in English. Talk to God in Hebrew. However you feel comfortable. You know, you've said your 19 brachas. You've said you hear the Ratzon and Reifi. You should say that in order to signal you have completed Shemona Esrei, but you haven't left. So this is a chance. Before you say Elokeinu Tzor, talk to the Ribono Shel Olam. I think it's a wonderful practice. If I was teaching Birat Tefillah, I would encourage my students. Say something to God. Say something fresh. Something new. Something you haven't said to God before. It can be words of praise. It can be a request. Whatever it is that you want to say. But say, just don't leave the Ribono Shel Olam without saying something of your own. And I think I have a feeling people aren't comfortable with that. And the reason why they're not comfortable with expressing themselves is that it makes them suddenly realize that they're talking to God. Even though they said 19 brachas, that message never came across. The minute they have to say something of their own, it suddenly hits them like a brick, like somebody hit them over the head. I am actually talking to God. And that's a wonderful, that should help make the 19 brachas more meaningful the next time you do it. The fact that you, suddenly the bell went off in your head, that you're talking to God. And so I think it's a wonderful practice. I didn't say anything about praise. It's foolish to add, you know, and you shouldn't say a Kehel Gadol Yibor Anora and then go on with a dozen other, because there's no end to it. But, you know, you thank, you know, you, there's got to be something that happened to you today that you'd want to thank God. Something happened today. So if you don't want to, you know, I'm not saying words of praise. Ask for something or thank God for something. You can certainly thank God for something that happened during the day. I know Mendy Gopin. I roomed with his brother Judah Gopin, Yudi Gopin, for 4 years at Yeshiva University. So yeah, I know the whole Gopin family. We grew up together. Yudi was my best friend, and so I know Mendy. I know the whole family. I didn't daven with the Rav. My father originally davened with the Talmud Rebbe, which is the Rav's Hutton, Talmud Rebbe's son, Yitzchok Twersky. Oliver Shalom married the Rav's daughter, Atara. We davened by the Boston Rebbe. And then the last years that my father was living, he davened in a shul called Hayodim, which is in Brighton, Rabbi Margolis and Rabbi Moskowitz. Nusach Spar is a developed after the Ari. And it was actually quite controversial because the Ari said that there were 12 gates. Well, they didn't exactly. Okay, the Spar does not, there's nothing in Nusach Spar that's not found in either Nusach Ashkenaz or among Sfardim. So it's really a cross between Nusach Ashkenaz and the Sfardic davening. It's really based on the Nusach Ari. It's an outgrowth of Nusach Ari. The Ari himself was a Sfard. People should realize that. He was a descendant of people who were thrown out of Spain. Again, another historical circumstance I would have liked to speak about, that the whole movement of the Kabbalim, in Sfat was the result of Geir Sfarad, about being expelled from Spain. They saw that as a great calamity. And then from Russia, how do you just go from Ashkenaz to Spar? Again, it was the Hasidim. You're missing the point that it was the Hasidim who apparently originated Nusach Spar. Nusach Spar from Nusach Ari. They went from Nusach Ari to Nusach Spar. I believe it began with the Hasidim. That's the little knowledge that I have about it. Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. I never get upset if somebody proves me wrong. There's a lot of speculation in the study of the Siddur. That's what makes it a wonderful subject, is that when you don't find a reason, you're sometimes forced to find your own reason, and inevitably it happens to be correct. The problem was that the Ari said that there were 12 gates for Tefillah, and apparently there were already 12 Nuschaot outstanding. And so Nusach Sfard was looked upon as a 13th. And you find Chuvas that talk about how do you fit in Nusach Sfard as the 13th gate, the 13th gate of prayer. That I did see. Well, Yekad Davni is Ashkenaz. You have to ask how we changed what is German, the German custom. Germans are the original Ashkenazim. So it's us. You have to ask questions about everybody else. They still follow the original. There's actually a wonderful organization. I think it's Moresh's Ashkenaz in Eretz Yisrael, who are working very hard to preserve the original Ashkenazic customs. They've written some wonderful svarim. They have a journal that comes out every year called Yerushasenu. It just came out with a book on the origin of Ashkenazic customs. It's actually in English. It originally came out in Hebrew. And this is a condensed version in English, which just came out. Wonderful sefer written by this group. But the original Yekis are the original Ashkenazim. So the question you have to ask is the rest of us. How different it is? Well, let me give you a few examples. The Yekis don't say Mizmor Shir Hanagas Bayis LeDavid before Baruch Shomar. That's one of the interesting questions. What is it doing there? Why do we say Kaddish after it? It's only one chapter of Tehillim. Why are we reciting a chapter of Tehillim before Pesuk Eid Zimra? It should be said after Baruch Shomar. They also say Bamei Madlikin. I mentioned Bamei Madlikin. They say it at the end of davening. At the end of davening a Ma'ariv, so they still stuck to that custom. Those are small differences. If you go to HebrewBooks.org and look for anything published by Rodelheim. Rodelheim was a big German publisher. There are Sidurim, there are Mazorim at HebrewBooks.org published by Rodelheim, and you can look at it and you can see the differences. You'll have to look hard because they're not substantial differences, but there are differences between the Yekeshim and Hagim. That's a good place to start. Yet, originally, one person would say Kaddish. The practice we have today of all the mourners saying Kaddish together is a Sephardic custom that Ashkenazim have adopted. Ashkenazic shuls that want to go back to the original custom, only because they have too many people saying it differently, so that it becomes like a circus. Nobody can actually hear the actual words of Kaddish. So I saw a tshuva from Rabbi Shlomo Avinar, who said that he, in his shul, he has gone back to having one person recite Kaddish, and he says if other mourners want to say it, they have to do it very quietly, whisper, so they don't interfere with that one person saying Kaddish. By the way, Yisrael, looks like I might be in Pesach for Shabbos. I'll be at a Gudah. I don't know if you daven in Gudah, but my daughter and son-in-law daven in Gudah. That's Rabbi Sachshul. Other side. I just swing by. Okay. Don't go out of your way. Don't go past Tchum to come. Any English books? You have to tell me whether you're willing to read books written by academic scholars. If you're willing to, then one name you can take is Stephen Reif, R-E-I-F, S-T-E-F-A-N. He wrote an overview of the history of the Siddur. Can you type in the name? Okay. And you have I have to give you a warning about Ismael Bogan. He wrote his History of Jewish Prayer in Germany in the 1800s. The first half of the book deals with the history of the Siddur, and it's an excellent history. But I have to warn you, the second half of the Siddur is his argument in favor of the Reform movement. So, interestingly enough, the Rav, when he gave his approval to the teaching of Biryat Tefillah at Maimonides, recommended Ismael Bogan's book to Rabbi Wolgemuth, which I found interesting only because, as I say, that book comes with a warning. The first half is very good. The second half I haven't even read, but I know that he's dealing with trying to justify the whole Reform movement. So that one comes with a little bit of a warning. Stephen Reif has no agenda. He just basically gives you the history. Those are probably the best two books in English. In Hebrew, they're wonderful books. I mean, Yesodos HaTefillah by Eliezer Levy is a classic. Of course, you have Rabbi Monk's book. What's the book? What's the name? I don't have it in this room, so I'm sorry. I can't. I have to leave. Go to another room. I guess I could. Hold on one second. Now you got it. That's it. You got it. Yeah, I can't find it. You got it. Yeah, that's it. New Perspective Jewish. Yeah, I think that's it. It's a paperback. It's a red cover. What on Amazon? That sounds about right. Maybe they have some discounts going on. Okay, so I guess I'll sign off now. If no one else has any questions, like I said, it was a pleasure, and perhaps we'll meet again. Take care of yourselves.